from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how breathing the right way can prevent high blood pressure, a study from the University of Melbourne, and how keratin, that's what your hair is made of and your nails are made of, shows significant potential to rejuvenate lost muscle tissue and function. Wake Forest University and University of Maryland and University of Virginia. And how milk thistle, a very important herb frequently used for men with enlarged prostates, can actually induce memory where there has been severe oxidative damage. That's from Shenyang Pharmaceutical University in China. And quercetin, that very important nutrient that's in apples and onions. It decreases insulin resistance and also helps in polycystic ovary syndrome. And that's from the Military Medical University in China. Plus, today we're going to take a more in-depth look at quercetin. I mention it all the time, and so there's a very good article in Life Extension called Quercetin Protects Against Pesticides Damaging Effects. So we'll share that with you. We always start with the latest on health and healing, and we'll do that today. And then I'm going to do commentaries, Reign of Idiots from Chris Hedges, Truth Dig, Robert Perry from Consortium News, The Existential Question of Who Do You Trust. I'll also be sharing a commentary that I prepared for you today about not just the importance of the First Amendment and freedom of speech, but what happens when the mainstream and alternative media, much of them, don't want to hear what you have to say, whether it's an article or a debate or a comment. They simply exclude you. I'll give you specific instances. Because when one group decides that another group should not have a forum, that means that at some point that can flip. And therefore, one day, people who consider themselves liberal are excluded from conservative sites, as right now is the case with many of the conservatives being excluded. I'm opposed to that, by the way. I'm opposed to saying that I don't like what you have to say, I disagree with it, therefore you should not be given a right to say it, and there should be no forum that allows you to say it. That's anarchy, and that really shows a lack of maturity, because for a long time, many of the most important, if not all the most important movements, the human rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, currently the anti-apartheid movement in Israel, is being denied forums. You cannot go on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and many other media and talk about, with evidence, not just opinion, what's going wrong with the Palestinians in Israel. They won't allow you. So there's many ways of suppressing freedom of speech. I'll share my own views on that on today's program. Also, we have a guest in the second part of our program today. We're always looking for guests that we consider important in opening our minds in ways that they have not been open before. This will be considered a part of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The title of today's guest segment is The Great Derangement: Facing Climate Change and Its Unspeakable Consequences in Literary, Historical, and Political Discourse. My guest will be Dr. Amit Ghosh, and he is internationally renowned for his work on these topics. He has also won the International Book Award and the Golden Quill Award and others, and he's one of those people that will be able to share some insights that we need to hear. So we have a lot to share. So let's begin now, and we're going to go through all of our different topics. I'm not sure I can get everything in because it's a packed show. I'll do the best we can. What we need to know is that we should be eating more whole grain. contrary to a very popular book, the author of which I, the author of whom I know, and he's a good doctor, but he wants us off those grains. Just the opposite is true. If he wants you off refined grains, I absolutely agree with that. But in point of fact, the actual scientific literature shows how we benefit from having whole grains in our diet. Why? Because they're rich in fibers, vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and phytonutrients. When your grandparents told you to eat your roughage, they were talking about the food that was in its more whole form. Now, they didn't know at that time because the studies weren't there to prove that it reduces cholesterol. It helps reduce our blood sugar. I'm talking about grains like kamut, K-A-M-U-T, spelt, S-P-E-L-T, and quinoa, and triticale. And also, even having popcorn is good for you. Millet, oats, rice, brown rice, of course, and wild rice. These are very important for us. Quinoa, Q-U-I-N-O-A, comes in many different varieties. These are not all true grains because they aren't members of the grass family, but incorporating more whole grains into our diet means that we are going more organic, because most of these you're only going to find organically, certainly the quinoas, and you're going to be doing a lot to maintain a pre-diabetic condition, lose weight, and be healthier. So just for those of you who have not been eating any grains because you believe that all grains are bad, no, the refined grains are bad. Also, we now have enough scientific evidence, the latest being from Dr. Joyce McCann and Dr. Bruce Ames from Chicago's Children's Oakland Research Institute, that we may not be getting enough of our vitamins. In fact, my research shows we're not. And the current levels that are recommended are just too low, and they were not scientifically evaluated. Most of what we're talking about as far as, well, make sure you get 100% of your RDA, recommended dietary allowance. Well, is that for optimally well people? Is that for people suffering from allergies, immune dysfunction, vaccine injury, environmental sensitivities? People do not exercise. People do not get up out of a desk very often or off a couch. Who exactly are those supposed to help? What if someone already has a deficiency of vitamin D, which is common, or calcium, magnesium? What if someone is eating a lot of refined carbohydrates or eating the standard American diet? Then a small amount of vitamins will not make a difference in that person's health. That's the fact. So all of the old recommendations for the amount of vitamins and minerals we need, I believe, are antiquated. I believe that they're unscientific. In fact, even at the time, I was asked by Senator McGovern, who led the panel on overseeing the RDA, I gave the head of his department thousands upon thousands of peer-reviewed studies showing the actual amount of nutrients that we required in order to be optimally well. About a year went by, and he called me, and he said, well, I've got some bad news. And I said, what? And he said, well, it's simple. He said, too many people with financial interest are on that committee, the committee that oversees the standards of how much of a vitamin mineral we should have. The egg board, the sugar industry, the refined carbohydrate industry, the meat industry, the chicken industry, they're all loaded on that committee. So their weight is dominant. And that's how it went down. There is no science in the federal government behind the ideal diet. It just doesn't exist, because the moment they tell you what an ideal diet is, the other side of the story will become apparent. Well, if you want me on a healthy plant-based diet, what's wrong with the diet I've been eating all these years? You know, I've been having sugar and soft drinks and coffee and artificial sweeteners and french fries and hot dogs and hamburgers and double hamburgers and triple hamburgers with cheese on it and bacon on it and big buns. What's wrong with that, since that's what we're all eating? and the pizzas and the deep-seated pizzas. Now they got pizza with cheese in the crust and cheese in the whole pizza. Well, these are all bad for us. They're all pro-inflammatory. Someone in the government would have to be responsible for telling the truth. Surgeon General, Health and Human Services Director. It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. You're never going to have anyone in the federal government ever, when it comes to health, tell you the truth about anything. Unless they say, don't smoke as often. Oh, wow. That's it? If we simply don't smoke as often, that everything else is perfect? Pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, artificial fertilizer, genetically modified foods, junk foods, sugars, refined carbohydrates, animal proteins, all the rest, that's okay? You see, the dilemma is, for those who are willing to tell you the truth about your diet, they would also suddenly have all the lobbyists, all of the ex-congresspersons, all the people calling them saying, you can't say that. That's a $200 billion a year industry. Do you want to be the person that causes all those unemployed people and factories to shut down and factory farming to close up? So that's why I never assume that anything the media or the press tells you about health is ever honest, because it isn't. So have your grains, but don't have the rest of that. Quercetin, very important nutrient, in my opinion, one of the 10 most important nutrients you should have every day, does a lot. Well, according to the Second Military Medical University in China, a new report in the Endocrine System Disease and Conditions talks about how quercetin can help you with insulin resistance. Well, when you consider how many Americans suffer from insulin resistance, are pre-diabetic or diabetic, you're talking about tens of millions of Americans. So what quercetin does, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, quercetin, it is an anti-inflammatory. You have inflammation in your body in the form of what are called cytokines, C-Y-T-O-K-I-N-E-S. And these can cause inflammation in your joints, your muscles, your heart, your brain, your liver, your kidneys. So the more quercetin you have, the more vitamin C you have, the more cytokines you're able to stop from doing damage. And that shows that quercetin significantly reduces the levels of blood insulin, interleukin, B1, interleukin-6, and tumor necrosis factor, alpha. All of those are pro-inflammatory. So quite simply, you're less likely to damage the tissue in your body. And milk thistle, which is an herb, helps with A-beta 25 to 35 induced memory deficits, which means in lay language that milk thistle helps your brain. And that's important, about 100 milligrams. And they have found that for the way we age, we start losing our muscle mass after the age of about 40. And the older you get, the more muscle mass you lose. That they've now found that keratin, K-E-R-A-T-I-N, used in different experiments, it's the human hair-derived keratin biomaterials, they found it can regenerate skeletal muscle. And that's promising new research. That's very important. That was published in Tissue Engineering. So for all of you who've ended up with muscle loss, weakness, fatigue, physical deformity because you don't have the muscle, we can reasonably expect this to be available in the very near future. So that's good. And that was University of Maryland, University of Virginia, and Wake Forest University showing us that. And also breathing in order to help prevent high blood pressure. This University of Melbourne, what they found is the most common type of hypertension, which accounts for 95% of people with high blood pressure, might one day be prevented by breathing exercises if caught early enough. Now, research at the University of Melbourne have uncovered unusual activity between neurons controlling breathing and blood pressure during the development of essential hypertension. Now, essential hypertension, which is high blood pressure with no known cause, affects 30% of the global population and is a major contributor to cardiovascular disease and death. This is what the lead researcher had to say on understanding the link between breathing and heart rate. Talked about how the breathing regulates the ability to slow down the heart rate before we end up having the hypertension, and that can make a difference. These neurons in the brain represent a potential target for therapies to prevent hypertension from manifesting in middle-aged. And so it's all about slowing down your breathing. And when you slow down the breathing, you slow down your heart rate. Now think of the times that you end up with excessive heart rate. Well, when you're exercising, but also when you're angry, when you're fearful, when you're rageful, when you're anxious, your blood pressure accelerates, your breathing accelerates, and that's where you're more susceptible to high blood pressure. So if you're able to have breathing control through the sympathetic nervous system, sending nerve signals to the heart and blood vessels, the altered neural activity leads to increased fluctuations in blood pressure with every breath and are seen in both the animal model and also in healthy adults, middle-aged adults. So you want to be able to calm yourself. So calming down and take some deep breaths and try to emotionally go to neutral. Then that relaxes the neurons. They're not overfiring. You're not creating a highly agitated, almost neurotoxic reaction in the brain. Blood pressure comes down. Most strokes occur in a lot of people when they've been angry, especially microstrokes. So breathe calmly, take some deep breaths. Remember, count to 10. It actually works. There's a whole science behind it. And finally, a little more depth on something else quercetin does. We're surrounded by pesticides. We know that pesticides kill pests. They also pose a danger to humans. Unprotected human exposure has been linked to cancer, endocrine complications, respiratory disorders, and organ failure. And more worrisome are studies showing pesticide exposure can increase risk of neurodegenerative diseases. Now, there are not just one or two or ten studies. There's a lot of studies indicating that the plant flavonoid quercetin can inhibit the damaging effects of pesticides. That's right. This is from Life Extension. Quote, pesticides are found in our food, air, and water. Harmful chemicals are so abundant in our environment that we often absorb them without eating food. With advances in manufacturing, many pesticides are no longer sprayed on crops. Instead, systemic pesticides are mixed in with fertilizer and absorbed by the plants through their vascular system. This makes it impossible for consumers to wash off pesticide residue because it's within the fruits and vegetables that you eat. While everyone is vulnerable to the dangers of pesticides, those especially at risk include children, pregnant women, sick people, and the elderly. Well, by the way, that's right there, over 80 million people. Pesticide exposure can result in conditions ranging from learning disabilities to Parkinson's disease to cancer. And because many different types of pesticides are used by farmers, exposure can overwhelm our efforts to stay healthy. When everyday lawn chemicals pose risks and can remain in our bodies for decades. So what's the answer? Quercetin. What I was just mentioning in the previous comments. It's a flavanol occurring in certain fruits and vegetables, and now research shows it has very positive effects in protecting the body against some of the dangers of pesticides. So what does it do? Well, a new study from the Journal of Human and Experimental Toxicology found that quercetin had protective effects against toxicity induced by a mixture of organophosphate pesticides, which were originally developed as biological warfare agents. So the study shows that quercetin can protect against organophosphate pesticide toxicity through preserving energy and fatty acids and sex hormone metabolism, inhibiting oxidative stress, protecting against DNA damage, preserving kidney and liver function. So that's good. So, we're not going to eliminate all pesticides, not in the near future. But what we can do, and we can do it now, is we can begin to take quercetin on a daily basis. I suggest 2,000 milligrams a day to start and go up from there. If you have cancer, I can assure you, or AIDS, I'm suggesting very high doses of quercetin. Generally, half the amount of quercetin as you're taking vitamin C. I've seen some remarkable benefit. And also just one of the best anti-aging nutrients you can take, because one of the reasons your skin wrinkles, sags, bags, you get that kind of hound dog jowy look, is because the collagen, the connective tissue that holds our skin in place, gives it its elasticity. It requires vitamin C and quercetin. So when you're not taking vitamin C and quercetin, you're not getting enough collagen. But when you do, all that can change. You can have remarkably resilient, tightened, much more youthful skin, and also it helps prevent the spider veins, bruising, tremendous benefit. And also it helps prevent a lot of the bleeding of the gums. And it helps fight cancer, and it's antiviral, and it's antibacterial. All good. That's it on health and nutrition. 21 minutes into the show. Back in a moment with more. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm broadcasting on the road now and back in New York in about 4 or 5 weeks to introduce a new documentary. When you look around at the people running the news media, I'm going to do several commentaries in one here. I did watch the correspondents get together where they come together with celebrities and slightly joke about each other. But we didn't need someone to make some slight, irrelevant jokes. We need a hard look at the people in the media, because they are the final filter. They're what determines what we believe, who we trust, and what impact it might have upon our perceptions, our reasoning, and our actions. If you're Chris Hedges, you believe that these people are idiots. If you believe people like Robert Perry, you believe that you can't trust them. He doesn't, and he was one of them. But he is uncompromising and looking for the truth no matter where it is. In fact, of all the different sources, none are ideological that I use. We have a group of scholars and residents, and we look very carefully at where do we get our information. Is it objective? Is it fair? Did they do their homework? Right now, as we speak, there are two really outstanding journalists in Syria getting the truth about the gas that was put into the proximity of people who died. But how it got there is what they're investigating. The mainstream media, not one will have them on. We will. We'll have them exclusively telling you the truth. Now, you would think with all those people at that dinner, surely one of their news agencies would have sent someone there to look for the truth. But it didn't happen. There are a lot of places they don't look for the truth. Where have they not looked for the truth? And why, therefore, should we not trust everything the media tells us? Because they did not tell us the full truth about the full background of Donald Trump, like the BBC did years ago. They also, not a single major of the mainstream media, nor the alternative media, including Democracy Now!, told us the truth about Gaddafi. He was not a threat to his people. In fact, the people of Libya love Gaddafi, and rightly so. Did you see any of the media, including Anderson Cooper, anyone else on CNN, show you Libya prior to the bombing and then after? No, because had they showed you Libya prior and just randomly stop people in the street to ask them, about Libya, they would have said things like, of all the Muslim countries in the world, Libya is the only one that grants women full rights as men. In fact, it was against the law to insult women in Libya. Compare that to Saudi Arabia that we praise, put on the UN Commission for Human Rights. Why was the media not, no one, talking about how can you have a country heading the Human Rights Committee at the UN that beheads more people and crucifies more people than any other country in the world? That makes no sense. Where were their voices? Where was their consciousness? What would we have thought if we saw the largest human-made water project, irrigation project in the world out of Libya to help at least 180 million or more Africans that did not have water have water? But that would have shown he was doing something good, and how the money, irrespective of how much he and his family might have taken for themselves, we expect a certain amount of kleptocracy in all of these countries run by these personalities, but their money actually went out of all the oil sales. It went into people's bank accounts. There was free medicine from birth to death. There was free education. There was no debt. There was billions of dollars in assets. There was no crime. And he was actively fighting the American CIA-backed terrorist in Benghazi. So we didn't have a before and after. The American media was responsible. Why has there been no expose of the central banks, like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and its impact upon the economies and people with structural adjustment around the world? Why have they not done a single expose on Monsanto? And why did they not tell us about the Crimes Tribunal indictment at The Hague about the history of poisoning people and the planet by Monsanto? Also, what about the accurate cost of life in the U.S., in the Middle East, before and after the wars, how people lived in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, before America intervened or its allies intervened? Why did the U.S. really put into power the people it wanted in Ukraine following U.S.-supported coup, the neo-fascists and Nazis? How would that have looked if a person in the media were able to report that? Also, the U.S. role in support of terrorist organizations. The truth behind domestic supremacist groups in the United States who are more dangerous than the Islamic terrorists. An accurate and objective expose of Netanyahu and who his biggest supporters are. All the specific evidence of glyphosate or Roundup as a carcinogen. The scientific evidence of bee colony collapse with pesticides and GMOs. Why our veterans are so mentally disturbed and their connection to prescription drugs. A hard look at childhood illnesses, then look at diet, vaccines, and corporate pollution. The real unemployment rate for the past dozen years of 22 to 24%. The detrimental effects of the entertainment industry on society and youth. A hard look at poverty across America and its real causes, from neoliberalism and capitalism, and the dangers of electromagnetic pulses, widespread corporate scandals and big pharma, an accurate expose of Wall Street, and how all these people who praise free market capitalism, every one of their firms had to be bailed out by we, the people, yet they do not like us, they do not support us, how the gross domestic product is a fraud, it's an absolutely fraudulent statistic. I defy any economist to come on this program, because I have a good background in business and economics. That was my first graduate, by the way. It wasn't in nutrition. That was second. Because I had to learn at an early time not to trust official figures. And I'm telling you that you cannot take upwards of 5% of the gross domestic product, which comes from people's debt. They cannot afford to buy something with savings. They go into debt to buy it. And we consider that a growing economy. You're not growing economy when you're growing debt. And yet that's what they think. And how about the 17% of the gross domestic product coming from Wall Street? That is also not growth because it does not filter down to the rest of the community. They're making money off money, the hedge funds, the equity partners. These people are economic genocidalists, in my opinion. These are the ultimate financial parasites of society. And yet they're the ones regaled for their acumen because they've made a lot of money. yet no one asked them the consequences of how they made their money to other people. If you took away all these socialist safety nets, all these major corporations would have been bankrupt, and we would have done better without them. But we don't have that story because no one in the media is willing to tell it. And what about the long-term results from hydrofracking? The earthquakes, the depleted fresh water, the illnesses, the immense pollution, the pipe blowout catastrophes. And what about the more immediate dark side of climate change? In fact, remember I said last week when I was talking about climate change, I said we are now in chaos theory. That don't just look at how hot it is on a given day. Look at the overall worldwide climate change, because climate change just doesn't mean it's going to get hotter. It also means that you can have not just a hot day, you can have global extreme weather patterns. A global warming also means you can change where water will fall, so you have torrential water in one area and arid areas also impacted. And that brings me to the issue, before we go to our guest, of the people running our country, running our government. And as Chris Hedges would tell us, these people are idiots. Yeah. I absolutely agree. The idiots take over in the final days of crumbling civilizations. Idiot generals wage endless, unwinnable wars that bankrupt the nation. Idiot economists call for reducing taxes for the rich and cutting social service programs for the poor and project economic growth on the basis of myth. And yet we only have one finite planet, and we're trying to live or motivate or inspire growth based upon having three planets. Instead of having one flat income tax that nobody could get out of, or corporate tax, let's say a 15%, right now the adjusted tax he wants to give corporations is without the mindset these people don't like to pay taxes. They're, even if you gave them a 1% tax rate, they'll find a way not to pay it. So we're not going to end up with more money trickling down to create the income flow to pay for these projects, because these are the minds of idiot economists. They never look at the real world because they're not accountable. Remember, most of these policymakers, policy wonks, and ideologues are not accountable for being wrong. Did you see mass firings of Judith Miller's and other at the New York Times when they were wrong about beating the drums for war with Iraq and 2003? No. No. You can be famous, wealthy, wrong all the time, and you continue to be famous, wealthy, and people still want your input. Idiot bankers gamble on self-created financial bubbles and impose crippling debt peonage on the citizens. Idiot journalists and public intellectuals pretend despotism is democracy. Idiot intelligence operatives orchestrate the overthrow of foreign governments to create lawless enclaves that give rise to enraged fanatics. Idiot professors, most in my opinion, the so-called experts and the specialists, busy themselves with unintelligible jargon and arcane theory that buttresses the policies of the rulers. Idiot entertainers and producers create lurid spectacles of sex scorn fantasy. There's a familiar checklist for extinction. We are ticking off every item on it. The idiots know only one word, more. They are unencumbered by common sense. They hoard wealth and resources until workers cannot make a living and the infrastructure collapses. They live in privileged compounds where they eat chocolate cake and order missile strikes. They see the state as a projection of their vanity. The Roman, the Mayan, the French, the Habsburg, the Ottoman, the Romanov, the Soviet dynasties crumble because the whims and obsessions, rulings of idiots. Donald Trump is the face of our collective idiocy. He is what lies behind the mask of our professed civility and rationality, a sputtering, narcissistic, bloodthirsty megalomaniac. He wields armies and fleets against the wretched of the earth, blithely ignores the catastrophe human misery caused by global warming, pillages on behalf of global oligarchs, and at night sits slack-jawed in front of a television set before opening his beautiful Twitter account. He is our version of the Roman Emperor Nehru, who allocated vast state expenditures to obtain magical powers. The Chinese Emperor Qin Shi Huang, who funded repeated expositions to a mythical island of immortals to bring back the potion that would give him eternal life. An arcade Russian royalty that sat around reading tarot cards and attending seances as their nation was descending into war and revolution. This moment in history marks the end of a long, sad tale of greed and murder by the white races. It is inevitable that for the final show, we vomited a grotesque figure like Trump. Europeans and Americans have spent five centuries conquering, plundering, exploiting, polluting the earth in the name of human progress. They used their technological superiority to create the most efficient killing machines on the planet, directed against anyone and anything, especially indigenous cultures, that stood in their way. They stole and hoarded the planet's wealth and resources. They believed that this orgy of blood and gold would never end, and they would be masters of it all. They do not understand that the dark ethic of ceaseless capitalist and imperialist expansion is dooming the exploiters as well as the exploited. They would just have a little longer before their hour comes. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Let's go now to my guest standing by, Amitav Ghosh. He is an international renowned novelist. His recent books, have received numerous awards, including the Arthur C. Clarke Award, the International Book Award, and the Booker Prize, and the India Gold Quill Award, among others. He is the author of The Great Derangement, Climate Change, and the Unthinkable, which is based upon a series of lectures given at the University of Chicago to address humanity's insane inaction to confront climate change. I'll spell his website, amitavghosh.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. It's very nice to be with you. I listen to you often, so it's good to be on your show.
Thank you. Over the years, writers and scholars have posted a number of great events now underway on the planet. There was the Great Warming, the Great Turning, the Great Transformation, and others. You're suggesting that we are now underway with a Great Derangement, and this pertains to humanity's failure across all institutions, including the arts, to include climate change accurately in our political, social, and public and entertainment discourses. So let's begin first with you explaining what is meant by the Great Derangement as a crisis of culture and imagination, and what are its causes and where is it leading humanity in the future? And in your answer, please include how our perception of Euro-American modernity has become so monolithic that it now drowns out all of the other voices of warning that need to be heard if we have any chance of addressing a catastrophic future in the making. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, it's a big question, but of course I've been thinking about these things for a long time. Let me just put it like this: what I mean by the Great Derangement, I mean absolutely the essence of the Great Derangement is that we live in an era where people worship science. You know, there's a kind of worship of a certain kind of science. And at the same time, people are not willing to pay attention to the most basic warnings that are coming out of the scientific community at this moment. You know, scientists are telling us that human activity is changing the global climate, that it's causing, say, for example, sea level rise, these tornadoes that you mentioned earlier in this show. And yet we carry on as though we could continue to live the lives that we've led for so long. I'll give you just one example of what I think of as this incredible derangement. That just today I read in a report that real estate prices in those areas that had been flooded by Hurricane Sandy are today higher than they were before the superstorm. So people are moving closer and closer to the sea. More and more people are actually investing in, you know, in real estate along beaches and so on. At the same time, as we know that sea level rise is occurring, that all these areas are going to be swamped. Any day, if you look at, if you open the papers and look at the real estate sections in Florida, so many people are building these giant condos right on the beach, and these are being sold to rich people who presumably have lots of money and are also well-informed, and they're actually buying these places. And this is happening, let me say, not just in America, but also in India. It's happening in China. It's happening across Asia. So this is a global phenomenon. You know, it's not just limited to the United States. We are seeing this derangement unfold across every continent on Earth now. So, you know, what actually lies behind this derangement? And I think, you know, we tend to think of climate change as being driven primarily, as primarily a matter of technology and so on. Yet what is actually behind it is a pattern of desire. And I think that is the aspect of it that we don't properly address. But what is it about living on the sea that is so desirable to so many people? You know, why is it that they are actually moving closer and closer to the sea? I mean, because human beings haven't always lived like this. You know, before the 17th century, in fact, human beings stayed away from the sea. They knew that the sea was full of, you know, posed certain sorts of dangers. So if you look at pre-modern ports around the world, they're actually, all of them are in locations that are actually sheltered from the sea. I mean, you just need to think of, say, London or Stockholm or Lisbon or, for that matter, Guangzhou in China or Hangzhou or old ports in India like Cochin and Surat. They are actually recessed from the sea. But it's actually a relatively modern phenomenon that people have developed this idea, this fantasy, really, that the sea is in some way so attractive that they want to move closer and closer to it.
Hmm. The U.S. has been on a trajectory of industrialization and geographical expansionism or empire building, even globalization since its founding in 1776. In Asia, particularly where you live, expansionism has not been as much of a geopolitical goal involving various forms of colonialism, such as economic colonialism, but rather of domestic industrialization and a race to enter the community of developed nations. It's also been the victim of Western corporate globalization and free trade. And you've seen the consequences of this firsthand with the vast displacement of people in India and Bangladesh due to resource depletion and natural catastrophes due to both climate change and the human impact of greed on the environment. So we're told that in the American mainstream press that India is like a miracle story, one of the BRIC nations. But you observe another side of the story that has not entered the public discourse, and that concerns the detrimental effects from modern capitalism and empire building, which is primarily economically and resource-driven. So can you please speak about the relationship between capitalism and imperialism upon climate? And second, how the ideology of the good life, promoted by the national and international leaders of post-modernity as being the ideal for all people, actually is a hoax, in my opinion, a fraud, and an ideal that can only be realized by a small minority of global population.
I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's absolutely the case that what we have, what is presented to the world today as an ideal of the good life is a complete hoax and an absolute fraud. Nobody can live like that. If every household in the world were to have, let's say, two cars and a washing machine and so on, the planet would asphyxiate very, very quickly. That's completely evident. But, you know, what is actually interesting is that for the last 20 or 30 years, actually going back even further to the Washington Consensus, as it was called, I mean, has been marketing this idea that, you know, the American way of life is the ideal way of life. This is the way of life that people should aspire to. And it's actually a kind of, that is actually a symptom of a sort of derangement, because the American way of life arose in a continent where, you know, that had ample resources and, you know, settlers arrived here. They, and as you know, we know this whole long history, the indigenous people were driven into reservations, and out of that arose this idea of what we might call a cornucopianism, that, you know, that the world will always provide more and more and more, that there are no limits, to what the world can provide. And now we see actually that there are very, very stark limits to what the world can provide. You know, I think it's often said that this is that climate change and capitalism is the essential thing. It's the essential driving mechanism behind climate change. And I think this is in many respects true. But I think we also have to note that capitalism is no single thing. East Asian capitalism, the capitalism that arose in, say, Japan and South Korea, there have been many studies which show us that this kind of capitalism is actually much less extractive and resource intensive than the Anglophone sort of capitalism that arose in, let's say, the countries of the New World, especially Australia, America, Canada, and so on. So even within Europe, there are forms of capitalism that are not as as resource intensive as American capitalism. This is true of, say, let's say, Germany and even Switzerland. So what we are really talking about here is a particular model of capitalism, a very highly resource intensive, extractive kind of capitalism that arose really out of Britain's encounter with the New World. So, I think it's important not to forget that, because, if you look at the models of capitalism that have now been adopted around the world, it has a lot to do with American influence and American power. And, for example, one of the motors of, let's say, the fossil fuel economy and especially the carbon economy really has been, the British and American power as it's been exerted around the world, since really the 1920s. So I think there are certain nuances to these things which are important to note. In my view, capitalism is not the sole driver of climate change. I mean, just as important has really is imperialism and the drive towards empire. Frederick Jameson, the literary theorist, has famously said that it's impossible to imagine the world without capitalism. I think actually what we are seeing today is that it's impossible to imagine the world without empire. Empire has become such a foundational factor of our contemporary global politics. It also needs to be said here that, today we are in a circumstance where around the world people have adopted these models. We are really in a circumstance of what we might call mimetic desire. People's desires around the world have been universalized and globalized, even in the smallest villages in India now, or in China or in Indonesia. You have television sets, advertising, and this has created a model of desire which is now common everywhere around the world. And it's this pattern of desire that is actually driving, this form of hyper-consumption. To me, what's particularly interesting, because I'm a writer and I'm in the sort of a field of culture and so on, is the lack of response actually from our culture, to these great disruptions that we are experiencing around the world. And I'll just give you one example of that. New York City, which has a greater concentration of writers and artists than almost any place in the world, was hit by this terrible superstorm. Sandy, large parts of the city were put out. It was a catastrophe for the city. And yet, are there any novels about this? Are there any paintings about this? And the answer is no, there aren't. And the same could be said also of, countries around the world. For example, Mumbai was hit by this terrible rain bomb event in 2005, when the city was completely swamped. People suffered terribly. Thousands were killed. People were separated from their families for days on end. And again, Mumbai is one of the great drivers of culture around the world. It has the world's largest film industry. There are lots of painters, writers, and so on. And yet, there's not a single film in which this catastrophe features.
I appreciate that unique insight. Thank you. I believe all of us are aware of climate change and global warming's imminent threats place blame upon our politicians and our corporate leaders and heads of international banks and institutions. Yet you observe that a lot of blame needs to be placed upon our artists and authors, and I would include popular musicians, actors, and actresses as well. Why should we be holding our artists accountable? Because normally they're given a pass, though I thought it was rather absurd that Leonardo DiCaprio should fly from the Cannes Film Festival to New Jersey to pick up an environmental award and then fly back in a private jet. I thought, where's the irony in that? But also on a more philosophical level, we credit artists with the powers of imagination, which they have. We rarely ever regard our CEOs and politicians as being visionary sages with humanist imaginative qualities. And we assign imagination to artists, writers, and musicians. So what role does the imagination need to play for us to, in order to find ways to convince more people about the dangers of climate change, what those are, and how to inspire solutions and new ways for people to take action?
Well, that's very well put. I do think that, thinking of alternative ways of life, thinking of alternative futures is not something that we can leave solely to bureaucrats and politicians. And unfortunately, climate change has really been claimed, as it were, by a small circle of international bureaucrats, technocrats, and so on. And ordinary people, and especially artists, and writers and so on, have really in many ways failed to engage with climate change, which is a very surprising thing because, the poet Shelley said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, and writers have really prided themselves for a long time on being at the forefront of many kinds of social and political movements, for example, gender rights, issues of sexuality and so on. And yet, within the community of the arts, really climate change has gone completely unnoticed. And I do think that's a very strange and a remarkable thing, because if you look at pre-modern art and pre-modern literature, they're filled with references to climate, references to nature, to our surroundings. But one of the strange features of modernity is that it's actually sort of suppressed our awareness of the world around us. We are much less responsive, really, to our environment and to our circumstances today than we were 500 years ago. And this, again, is one of those strange and ironic aspects of contemporary life, that even as our environment is turning against us, we are less and less able to factor it in into our daily circumstances, into our daily ways of living. I should say here that you mentioned Leonardo DiCaprio. I think something I do feel that within the world of the arts, Hollywood actors, surprisingly, have been much more receptive to climate change than, painters or sculptors or indeed novelists. So, I think this is greatly to their credit. I mean, they can't help it if they're also, rich or whatever. And I do feel that, one of the real dangers of speaking of climate change in terms of, say, individual consumption is really that we've tried to reduce this problem. We often reduce this problem to a question of, individual choices and personal predilections and so on. Whereas really it's the collective and institutional factors that need to be addressed. And, one very simple example of this is really that, the U.S. Pentagon is the single largest consumer of fossil fuels, not only in America, but in the whole world. In fact, the U.S. Pentagon uses more fossil fuels than two-thirds of the world's countries. Now, individual choices are really sort of powerless in front of an institutional factor of that kind. So this is really a question, it requires collective action, and it's not, we can't expect it to be solved by individual choices. So whereas it is true that it's maybe ironic that DiCaprio chooses to fly around the world in this way, It's also true that, you know, he has done a substantial amount to alert people around the world to the dangers that we face.
I agree. I also wish that Al Gore would be an example and create a 100% sustainable environment for his own personal domicile and show, you know, that, hey, you can do it. I've done it. You can do it. I believe that they should be both good speakers, which they are, but also good models of that behavior, vegan and a humanistic and spiritual. And that I've yet to see. But I'm very impressed by your book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. There's a lot of positive solutions. And I look forward to a longer conversation with you on this topic in the future.
Thank you, Gary. It's been a pleasure to be on your show, and thank you for having me.
Okay. My guest is Amitav Ghosh, and he is part of our conversation with the Remarkable Minds. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.